Note by narrator with regard to early radio in Long Beach. I cannot add much, I'm sorry, about early radio. About 1924, we kids were getting excited about radio, and I remember I built my first crystal set at the time, equipped with Galena crystal and the proverbial cat's whisker. We listened with earphones, and about the only thing which I could pick up on that little crystal set was tinny music and tinny voices from radio station KFON, which of course was the station that the Echophone radio interests had acquired. About 1925, a friend gave me a disassembled kit for a three-tube radio put out by the Elgin Super Reinhardt's Radio Company, and after dint of much slaving over this kit until the small hours of the morning, I was able to put it together and listened via earphones to other Long Beach radio stations. In 1926, I acquired a much more grandiose set, a four-tube Atwater Kent radio. And since I was living on Signal Hill, I utilized the several oil derricks around our house to serve as masts for a large antenna system. And with this tremendous spread of antenna coming down from these derricks, I was able to pick up stations in Japan and Schenectady, New York, to say nothing of KDKA in Pittsburgh, WSMB in New Orleans, KOA in Denver, and I won a number of prizes put out by Ken Ormiston of Radio Doings for the listener who could log and authenticate the farthest stations on his set. In that year of 1926, I was going to Woodrow Wilson High School in the east section of Long Beach, and since that was the first year of the high school's operation, there were a number of new clubs being formed, and I formed the radio club of Woodrow Wilson High School. At the first meeting of this club, I was nominated for the position of president, and another high school student was nominated for the presidency. His name was John Hancock. John won the vote and became the first president of the radio club of Woodrow Wilson High School, and that started a friendly rivalry between John Hancock and myself. And it was interesting that it seems interesting to me that in later years, much later, when I was working for Hancock Oil Company, that John was the president of Hancock. But of the two achievements, what lingered longest in my mind was the fact that John had defeated me for the presidency of the radio club, which I had organized. Narrator's note. Following is a description of the so-called Hell's Half Acre, or the hotspot directional oil drilling operations. In the early 1930s, the techniques of controlling the direction of a drilling bit became fairly well known in the oil fields. And there were many applications of this directional drilling technique, applications that were both legal and illegal. For example, a legal application would be, say, in Huntington Beach, California, where the oil structures extended out under the ocean, and it was not practical or feasible to drill wells from platforms out in the ocean. So wells were drilled from the onshore locations and then slanted out under the ocean into the leases granted by the state. This was the legal application of controlled or directional drilling. However, in the early and mid-1930s, certain unscrupulous operators utilized this principle of directional drilling to benefit from the areas that had legally producing wells on them. These operators would secure leases along the edge of the field, leases on property which had been abandoned many years before as being unproductive. They would erect the derrick there and start to drill. But unbeknownst to everybody except themselves, they controlled the direction in which the drill went, and they drilled under the properties of people that did have oil-bearing sands under them. In the Signal Hill case, these wells were drilled up under the leases of the major oil companies. In particular, they were directed under the leases held by the Union Oil Company in their Long Beach community lease. And also, some of these wells were directed under the Sunnyside Cemetery and the Long Beach Cemetery, located on Willow Street near California Avenue. The Long Beach Cemetery Association knew that they were sitting on top of an oil field, but of course they couldn't drill on their own properties there where the graves were located. So various enterprising promoters and operators made arrangements with the Long Beach Cemetery Association to obtain a lease on a piece of property just outside the oil-bearing area and slant drill underneath the cemetery, paying the Cemetery Association royalties. And this was a legal operation, providing, of course, that the operators received right-of-way permits from property owners under whose lands they had to go in order to direct the drill under the cemetery. If all that had been done and the proper easements granted, then they had a legal oil well. But other people would take a lease next to them and either drill illegally under the cemetery or slant their drill up underneath the producing formations, and particularly, which I've just mentioned, underneath the Union Oil Company Long Beach community lease. Now, all of this, of course, didn't sit too well with the major operators on Signal Hill, who had invested a fortune in obtaining leases and were presumed to be able to enjoy the fruits of their labors. Well, soon that whole area in this particular section of the Long Beach oil field was clustered with new derricks being built. From the time the first illegally operated derrick or illegal well was drilled until an injunction was obtained to shut them down, well over 150 illegal wells had been drilled up underneath the major oil companies producing formations. The main activity, the hot spot of this illegal operation, lay just west of Cherry Avenue and south of Willow Street, and was bounded on the south by approximately Hill Street, and on the west by California Avenue. This was the hot spot, or as it was also dubbed, Hell's Half Acre, and it was a frenzied scene indeed. These wells that were illegally drilled on the edge of the field in areas which had been condemned as being non-productive suddenly began coming in. Now, no miracle had occurred, and the major oil companies knew very well that there was no miracle being presented to them. They knew that these wells were drilled underneath the major oil companies' leases. But how to prove it? In the meantime, the wells kept coming in, fine big wells, 300 barrels a day, 500 barrels a day, 800 barrels a day, some as much as 1,000 barrels a day. They were drilled on a shoestring. Operators with very little money, with only $2,000 or $3,000 of so-called front money, would hire drilling crews for $1 a day cash and $6 a day out of oil, or they would issue royalty certificates to their drilling crews in fractional percentages, 0.25%, 0.5%, 0.5%, and the drilling crews sold these fractional interests to investors or speculators or other promoters, and there was a large underground business being operated at that time, selling and trading these percentages. Eventually, of course, the end purchaser of the percentage units lost when the wells were shut down, as they were. But for a while, it seemed as if everyone was making money. The promoters were making money. The suppliers of oil well equipment were making money. Many of the oil well equipment people took percentages or fractions of percents in these illegal wells, winked at the illegal activities, said and quoted such platitudes as oil is where you find it, or oil is a migratory substance and you're perfectly free to chase after it. Nobody knows where the drill is, and nobody is going to find out, and so forth and so on. So, as I've said, the percentages were traded back and forth. Many, many of them sold on the Los Angeles and Long Beach stock exchanges, and even the stock exchanges as far distant as New York City, where the prices were grossly inflated because the name of Signal Hill was a magic name, and it was considered to be a chance of a lifetime to buy a royalty percentage or two in a Signal Hill producing oil well. Percentage units which actually were worth only about $500 a piece in Long Beach, and that price only paid by those in the know, would be sold for as high as $2,000 or $3,000 in New York City. It was really a shame. A great, great many people, innocent purchasers of these percents, lost money. But in the meantime, the illegal wells were being drilled, and every manner of subterfuge was used to hide the fact that they were being drilled illegally, directed illegally. Even the direction was deliberately confused. These wells always seemed to be spudded in at midnight. And at some stage of the operation, a whipstock was inserted in the hole, or an elbow-jointed piece of drill pipe was put in, and off went the well in the direction the driller wanted it to go, sometimes by a very circuitous route. Then when the well hit the oil sands and the tubing was put in the hole to produce the oil, this tubing was screwed together with only a few threads holding it, so in case anybody went into the hole and tried to pull the tubing in order to run a survey to see where the well was bottomed, the tubing presumably would part and junk up the hole, and it couldn't be proved from whose land the well was producing. But eventually, of course, the major oil companies, primarily Union Oil Company, got together, and these companies were able to get a court injunction against all of these wells drilled in the so-called Hell's Half Acre. They shut every single one of them down, and methodically they went into these wells, they pulled the tubing, they pulled the sucker rods, they went in and surveyed each hole, and they found out exactly where the wells were bottomed, and every single one of the wells were drilled and bottomed underneath a major oil company producing property. So there were no penalties assessed. The main drive of the major oil companies was to get this practice stopped. So an arrangement was worked out that nobody would be prosecuted and no damages would have to be paid, providing the operators plugged up the holes and quit all of this nonsense. And that was what was done. Every single one, perhaps there was one or two exceptions, but I'm not sure of any. Every one of these illegal wells was plugged up, the derricks torn down, and the ground graded, and the illegal activity was stopped. The small independent operator in the 1930s during the Depression had a most difficult time arranging financing to drill a well. However, many of these operators, or promoters, if you wish to call them that, were quite resourceful. And it was a common practice to finance a well, that is, finance the drilling of an oil well, with an initial stake or front money of only from $3,000 to $7,000. There were certain things, of course, which could only be obtained or purchased with money, but there were many things which could be arranged for the drilling of an oil well by the trading of percentage units. Many operators, including myself, used this method, and it was fairly commonplace. For example, you would get an attorney who had a certain expertise in oil matters and who would form a corporation for you and do all the necessary legal work, and his fee would be from 1 1/2 to 2% of the well. Bearing in mind now that there are 100% in each oil well, and the owner of the land from whom the property was leased would generally receive 16 2/3% or perhaps 20%. Then there could be what was termed an overriding percentage in case you had to obtain the property from a lease broker. He would get from 2 to 3%. So generally, the small shoestring promoter or operator would start off with perhaps 16 to 18 to 20% already given away to the landowner or perhaps a broker. So therefore, he would have 80% of the well to play with. Now, he couldn't give it all away, of course, although some operators did, particularly in the very early days of drilling in the 1920s. In fact, some of the operators gave their entire well away or rather sold more than 100% and found themselves in the unenviable position of not being able to bring their wells in because they probably would have gone to prison. You can't sell 120% of anything. But back to the 1930s during the Depression, your attorney would take, as I say, from 1.5 to 2%. You would then have a foreman or tool pusher, or what is known as a drilling supervisor or superintendent. His fee was negotiable. Generally, you paid him $400 or $500 of eating money and gave him from 3 to 4% to oversee the drilling operations. He then would hire a crew, and in some instances, the crews were paid $1 or maybe $2 a day for eating money, and then perhaps a fraction of a percent. Most percents in a proven area were calculated to be worth from $400 to $700 apiece. So you might give each member of the crew a couple of dollars a day for eating money and perhaps 1% or 1 1/2 percent for a drilling job that was supposed to take perhaps 45 days to 2 months to complete. The driller on each tower would receive perhaps $3 a day and 2%, because he was the boss of that particular shift or tower. Then you could acquire tanks. Usually all the material the promoters used for these drilling operations, these shoestring operations, was used material. The supply stores, particularly those lining Cherry Avenue in the Signal Hill area, had a large inventory of used boilers, drill pipe, casing, tubing, tanks, mud pumps, drilling machinery, and so forth. And it simply became a matter of negotiation. You would haggle with them. You would offer this, they would counter with that. But eventually you ended up where you could do a lot of trading with that 75% that you had left in your oil well. Usually second-hand derricks were purchased, wooden derricks that had either not been used to drill or had been erected in a burst of optimism out at the edge of the field, could be dismantled and trucked over to your site, wherever it was. That had to be purchased in cash, of course. That's why you needed $3,000, $5,000, or $7,000 in cash. Certain things had to be purchased with cash. Then you would erect a derrick on your lease, and that had to be paid for in cash generally. Of course, every small-time operator did his level best to trade some percentages for what he needed. But that was how it was done. If the well came in, then everybody profited. If the well didn't come in, the shoestring operator lost his front money of $5,000 to $7,000, and everybody else who didn't take cash lost their time or labor when they exchanged those for percentages. But usually, if you were drilling a well in an area that had a fairly good chance of making a producer, you found it much easier to raise money by the trading of percentages. If a producing well was obtained, then the holders of the percentages could hang on to those percentages and draw an income from royalties, which the operator then would pay for each percentage that he had issued. Or the owner of the percentages, say a driller or a supply house or whoever, could sell his percentages in the open market to brokers who were always looking for such thing. The general rule was that is, for people who were knowledgeable and had a percent or two in a producing well, when that well came in, they would hold the percentages for 1 or 2 months while the flush production was going, and collect royalties on those 2 months, and then sell their percentage units. Up until the time the Securities and Exchange Commission was established to safeguard abuses in the selling of securities, the buying, selling, and trading of oil well percentages was a brisk and somewhat unethical enterprise. And because of this, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, established certain rules for the selling of percentages in an oil well. The greatest abuse of the percentage selling schemes was that many operators would get panicky when they saw that their costs were apt to be so high, and they would hastily sell off the percentages in their wells and perhaps drill only 500 or 800 feet and then decamp with the money which they had raised from the selling of the percents. It was for this reason, to protect potential investors, that the SEC established that oil well percentage units were indeed securities and fell within the jurisdiction of the SEC. And one would have to file, that is, the operators would have to file detailed papers and prospectus with the SEC to get permission to sell these percentages. Each well had to have it figured out what it would cost to complete it, keeping in mind certain contingencies. And then the SEC would determine that each percentage in a well would be worth or could be sold for, say, either $400 a percent or $700 a percent or whatever, depending upon two general factors. One, what would it cost to drill the well to completion? And two, the location where the well was going to be drilled, was that location a very good chance to develop a producer? In other words, was it in a proven area? Was it a wildcat? Was it on the fringes? And by a series of mathematical equations and a lot of discussion back and forth between the promoter and the SEC, it was arrived at that the securities, that is the percentages, would have to be sold for not less than, say, $500 per unit. Well, this made it difficult sometimes for the operators to sell units, particularly in an area where it was problematical if the well was going to be a success. And the operators, of course, then wanted to offer these units for $300 to $400 apiece and not have to go to $500. It's easier to sell a unit for $300, obviously, than it is to sell the same percentage unit for $500. So there were some subterfuges worked out. I might mention just one. For example, let's say I was the promoter, and I was the president of the Hoositz Oil Company. I was also the general manager of the Hoositz Oil Company. And on the books, it would show that the Hoositz Oil Company was paying me for my services as general manager, let's say $500 a month. Now, I never received any of this money at all, but it showed in the books that a check was issued to me in cash for $500 for my monthly services. Then I would go to Joe Doakes, who, let's say, was a royalty broker or a potential investor. And I would say, look, Joe, I'm going to drill this well, and the SEC has given its okay for me to sell units, securities, and I'd like to sell you 10 units. They're worth $500 apiece for a total of $5,000. But maybe Joe Doakes would demur. He would say perhaps he didn't think it was such a good deal, but he might be interested at $350 apiece. And then the promoter, myself in this case, let's say, as a hypothetical example, would haggle back and forth and finally make a deal to sell Joe Doakes 10% units for $400 apiece or $4,000. But Joe Doakes would give me a check for $5,000, which would then satisfy the requirements of the Security and Exchange Commission. I would deposit that check. But out of the $500, which I had ostensibly received for my month's salary, I would give Joe Doakes the difference between the $4,000 which we had agreed upon and the $5,000 which he paid me, in other words, $1,000. I would hand him that money, so-called under the table, and in that way discount the value or the cost of the percentage units. And it never could be proved by anyone that I had discounted the percentage units illegally and had sold them actually for $4,000 for 10 units instead of the required $5,000. That was one of the ways that the SEC provisions were circumvented, and there were others, but time doesn't permit my going into all of that, at least not at this time. Narrator's note, I see I'm running out of this last tape. I'll try to answer as many other questions as I can, but don't be surprised if the tape should end abruptly. The so-called Painted Hills area, where a number of directional but legal wells were drilled in Signal Hill in the 1930s, was an area running approximately from the corner of Juanapero and 21st Street east along 21st Street for perhaps 1,000 yards. Just south of 21st Street was was a more or less cliff-like geological structure, and about 20 acres in that area between Juanaperro and the eastern boundaries of this so-called Painted Hills area was open to drilling, and the wells drilled directionally up the hill but stopped at the boundary lines and were bottomed just behind a fault, which made some rather good producers in the 1930s. The wells came in all the way from 200 to 800 barrels apiece, and well, I happened to participate in the drilling of one of those wells, and it stayed on production.